Okay, the basic premise of spiritual practice is that just as there is an objective physical body, which we all see, there's an objective, what you would call the subtle body, sometimes people call it that, they call it the energy body, the astral body, there's all these different words. And all the movies and the television these days are really very helpful for explaining this, because now anytime anybody dies in the movies, you know, the same actor stands up and he walks around and he's just the same, except his body's not physical anymore, so he can go through the walls and the physical people can't see him. There's actually a lot of spiritual truth in that. That the physical body is the last layer of something that starts farther back, and it moves, it starts at a point where it can't be perceived with the physical senses. Although people have out-of-body experiences, they have near-death experiences, sometimes people can see energy forms, you know, they'll read auras and things like that that you may have heard about. And the premise of this is a really interesting one. If you think about anything in this world, it actually has three dimensions to it. I always use our new school building as the example. First, there had to be the thought that we would build a new school building. Then we had to put out the energy to make a blueprint for the school building, and then we finally built it. And the thought and the thing we finally built, you know, resembled each other, but it never would have happened without three of those layers happening. So the metaphysical explanation of our own physical life is that we also have, there's the physical body, and then there's the energy body, which is the blueprint of this body, and then there's a higher level even still, which is just the thought of our reality. You don't have to really go to all of those. But the premise of the chakras is based on the fact that the chakras are the energy pattern. In the physical world, we'd say it would be the blueprint for the building. We had to have an exact blueprint, and then from that blueprint we made the building. And so in the metaphysics, they say that there's an energy pattern that is the blueprint that the physical body resembles. And what they're doing in the movies, when the physical body dies, hello Jack, is the energy body just gets up and walks away. Okay. And it's the same, except it doesn't have a physical body. Jack, we're going to talk about the chakras a little bit because Joy Lynn asked a question. Okay. So, in the physical body, we understand that the spine is a key to our physical well-being. There's a whole science of osteopath and chiropractic both, which is all based on the spine. There's energy that runs down the spine, and you have nerve centers, the heart, you know, the solar plexus, and lower down in the groin. And these are areas where a lot of nerves are concentrated, and then all the nerves go out to run the whole body. Well, the energy blueprint for what becomes those physical centers is, oh goodness, okay. What is your name?
Nandini.
Nandini. Okay, you're in the sixth class.
I am.
Are you? Which class are you? What class are you for?
I thought I was in the third class.
Maybe another class she's looking for.
What class are you looking for?
The meditation.
For
living with
the class. Yeah. This is actually the last class of six.
Class.
You're more than welcome to be here.
Yeah,
except
right.
We might have to start over. Because that was just
that's perfect then. I'll ask you next.
Because Jolene asked a question about self-awareness and the difficulty of keeping track of your own actual feelings and what you're thinking. I was going to help answer that question by talking about the chakras and how energy is stored and how it influences our consciousness.
Sure.
Okay, because Jolene didn't know anything about the idea of the chakras. I was starting at the very beginning.
I practice yoga and meditation, so I'm kind of well aware of the subject,
okay.
So I can follow through.
Okay.
Thank you.
Fearman knows, and I'm
not very familiar.
Okay.
Right now.
Okay, so what we're basically talking about is the chakras are the energy pattern and the physical body is the manifestation of it. That may, you know, may or may not resonate, but let's just say that's true. So just as there's a physical pattern in the physical body that we can see, the saints and the yogis and the masters tell us that there's an energetic pattern And it also guides us, but guides us on a more subtle level. Okay. So the energy pattern, and I'm a terrible artist, but I'll just draw the picture. Here's the person. Okay. And the chakras, there's seven in number. And there's the base chakra, which is at the base of the spine. There's the second chakra, which is about 2 inches above approximately where the sex organs are, where the genitals are. There's the third chakra, which is where the belly button is. And there's the fourth chakra, which is where the heart is. Fifth chakra is at the throat. The sixth chakra is between the eyes. And there's also the balancing chakra to the one between the eyes. You can't see it as the medulla under there, right here. I'll explain that in a minute. And then there's what's known as the crown chakra, which is the seventh. Okay. Now, the great dilemma of our lives, from the question that you asked, is the fact that when things happen, they don't seem to go away. Right? You have a bad interaction with your child, you have a fight with your husband. You get mad about something, and it just doesn't seem to go away. And even if it's not quite like active in our memory, it still doesn't go away. You know, we're sad about things, we don't know why we're sad. We make a resolution that we're going to go do something, and no matter how determined we are, we keep finding that our energy does something else instead. That's the problem that every single person who sets out to redirect their life by conscious choice finds that they run into a huge amount of trouble doing it. The reason are the chakras, and here's what this represents. Our human life is actually going somewhere. And I talked about this earlier when I was talking about education for life, that what we're teaching the children is ever-progressive states of awareness. And we were saying that if there is a meaning to life, and if that meaning to life is ever-increasing states of awareness, we talked about Satchitananda and self-realization the first night, then we want to be educating the children in such a way that everything that they're doing contributes to the main event. And the main event really isn't to get into college or to get the job afterwards. Even though it's nice to be able to do those things, the main event is their fulfillment as a human being, because if they obtain those things and fail in their hearts and in their spirits, then, I mean, what parent would want that for their child? Of course, you're looking for everything. But nonetheless, the capacity to do things in life, succeed in life in an outward way, is largely determined by what your inner energy is like. I mean, the brightest people in the world do not succeed if they can't master their emotions, if they have terrible anger, if they're lazy, if they can't follow a straight line, you know. So, and we try to just sort of educate the facts into them without ever training the vehicle that's going to be able to use that knowledge. And so education for life is, let's train the vehicle, because if the vehicle's trained, I mean, think about your own lives. If you're scared at work, if you're angry at work, if you're frustrated at home, if your heart is closed to the people who are with you, I mean, nothing follows. But when you feel at peace with yourself, when you feel kindly disposed to the people around you, when you have patience, when you have a sense of inner joy, nothing else is a problem. You know, all the things that look like such big problems, how will I get this project done? How will I get the kids off to school? How will I explain this issue to my son? They're only problems when you're a mess inside. And when you've got yourself organized inside, yeah, there are things that have to be done. Some of them are more pleasant than others. But nonetheless, the enormous obstacle is not the outer things, it's always the inner things. And you know, both, some of you have talked already about your children, about what you see in your children, both obstacles that they have and then how the teachers are working with them. Because the teachers know that if that child does not begin now to master those shortcomings, then it really doesn't matter how smart he is. Even if he manages to fake his way through or her way through a whole lot of stages of life, sooner or later that's going to wear him down. And so we start right now when it's so blatant, because the children, when they're young, they haven't yet learned to cover it over. They haven't learned how to look good. So they have it all out on the table. And that's the time when you can begin to reorient them not by you'd better behave differently, but by pay attention to your own experience. You know, look, you constantly have trouble with this person. You constantly are in a struggle over here. You're really not, you know, getting it together in this area, but not scoldingly, but just, you know, how can we work to make these things better? Now, in the concept of self-realization, you know, going back, way back to our first class, we have essentially the concept that we exist on a spectrum, and that spectrum, I'll make it a horizontal one now, is from complete commitment to what you see is the only reality there is. I mean, and we know people who like that, they don't believe in God, they don't believe in spirit, they don't believe in chakras, they don't believe in anything. It's just money, things, power, person, whatever it might be. People like that. I mean, people can be, this are people who are murderers. Because, like, what difference does it make? You know, it doesn't. I read a fascinating story in the Reader's Digest about a woman whose daughter was murdered. And she was so consumed with anger. The man was found, convicted, and sent to jail. But she was so angry, she could see it was just destroying her. So she went to, she thought maybe if she talked to the man who killed her daughter, it would help her. But she was astonished to find when she talked to him, he had no idea what harm he caused. He was so engaged in his own reality and just so lost in his own picture of things, he didn't even know that taking her life had an effect on anyone. And the rest of the story was how they became friends. And now he just began to move up the spectrum from his self-centered subconscious, remember we talked about that, reality. So that's one end. And the other end of the spectrum is the Christ-like masters, whose consciousness is infinite. This individual doesn't even know there's anybody on the planet besides him. This individual's consciousness is unified with everyone on the planet, is the Satchitananda. Every single thing that you do in life, every action you take, every thought you have, every feeling, every word, falls somewhere on that spectrum. You're either affirming your self limited reality. My happiness comes when I get what I want. There's nobody else on the planet but me. That man felt like killing that woman for who knows what reason. He just did it. Didn't even think about the reality. And you don't have to be a murderer. I have, there are people that I know who I joke sometimes, they really don't know there's anybody out there. They're just always, you know, just cycling around in their own world. You know, they just don't even know there's anybody in the world but them. You may know people like that. Okay. And then there's people who are like Mother Teresa of Calcutta, or just, you know, maybe your grandmother or your own mother, just, or your own wife or husband, just somebody very generous hearted. And everything they do considers, you know, what everybody else needs. It's bigger than. It's somewhere on the spectrum. Now, we think once we do something, it's gone away. Because where is it? You know, I got mad at my son, and where is it? I had a terrible day at work. Where is it? We don't know where it is. It's gone. In time, it seems to have gone away. But this spectrum corresponds to from the lowest to the highest chakra. This chakra, we recognize ourselves as one with the Christ. This chakra, which is called the earth chakra, because it represents the material world, this is our absolute commitment to matter as the only reality. Okay, now there's more complex about the chakras, but I'm just going to put it there like that for the moment. And these are not actually, the reason they're called chakras, chakra means wheel, these are whirlpools of energy. Okay? And so these are actually whirling fields of energy, because the chakras are not a physical system, they're an energy system. The energy body is a pattern of energy. And every time you have a thought, action, feeling, anything that you do, because we believe ourselves to be the doer, the energy, whatever it is stored in the chakra as a whirling pool of energy. You can't think of this physically. There's no physical limit to this, because this is not physical. This is just energy. So if I am very, very angry because I was passed over for a promotion at work, and so I start out being, let's say I put it, where would it be? I'll put it in my power center. I'm really angry that I didn't get that promotion at work.
And so then I become really angry about at my boss, and we start spinning things around that thought. My boss is really a terrible person, and oh, I had such a good opportunity to sabotage his future yesterday, and then the other girl at work who was so rude to me about my not getting it, and then you just sort of get this. And each one of these individual actions is built around some central idea, whatever it might be, of my self-worth, my being hurt, or alternatively, oh, I have such a wonderful family. You know, I just love my family so much. I think I'll just, today I'm going to go to town and I'm going to get their favorite foods and I'm going to make them this wonderful meal and we're going to have such a happy experience here. Or maybe I'm going to meditate and I'm going to pray very deeply and maybe I'm going to have a real strong feeling of God's presence today. That's our lives, isn't it? Just all of these different things. This is our security. This is our creativity. This is our personal power. This is our heart reaching out in love. This is where we communicate and feel a sense of unity. This is where we feel the power of God. And we all exist on all these levels at all the same times, don't we? And each of these chakras also has a positive and a negative way of expressing itself. So what happens, and I'm going to truncate this a little bit, because it was really to talk about Joy Lynn. Over the course of a day, a lifetime, an incarnation, many incarnations, we begin to create an energy pattern in the chakras that is exactly corresponds to the sum total of every thought, action, and thing that we did in the entire incarnation. And because this is not a physical reality, but an energy reality, when the physical body dies, the energy body is what goes forward. And it's us. It's not like something else. It's us. Because our physical personality, this is the blueprint that made the body. This is the blueprint that made the personality. This is how karma, cause and effect in human life, is carried from one incarnation to the next. This body dies, but the energy pattern that I've created over the course of my lifetime sails off into the astral world. Christians call it heaven or hell, but you sail up into the astral world. You hang out as an energy body with a lot of other energy bodies in the astral world for a while until this energy pattern calls you back to the physical world, and then you find yourself in a baby's body. All of you have children, that's why you're here. And you know, I mean, I've never carried a baby, but those of you who have or have held a newborn, those children are different from conception. They're different from the moment you hold them in your hands because they're not blank slates. The body that they made, the very fact that they became your child, is because there was a blueprint in their energy pattern that meant to be Eden, to be Joseph, to be Jaya, was right there. Jaya was exactly the right vehicle for this energy pattern. Now this requires reincarnation and a whole lot of other things. Now, just from the point of view of what you were saying about your own feelings, so you can have, let me draw the picture like this now. Because these are whirling fields of energy, this is the image, and that's Joy Lynn, this is the one I really wanted to put in front of you. Our energy is always trying to flow. You know, when we're doing this meditation, we're following the breath. And that breath represents the energy flowing up and down the spine. Eric reminded me that I never really talked to you yet about really getting that energy flow up and down the spine. Furman's had Kriya, and he knows where that's where you're going with this. You're starting with just breathing, but where you're really going is into the energy flow up and down the spine. If you progress with this, that's where you'll go. So the energy this is what we live by, is this energy flow in the spine, and it actually circulates like this. And it circulates up and down, and that corresponds to the up and down flow of energy. It feels like it's flowing up and down. We don't have to worry about how it's actually going. For now, up and down is good enough. But what happens is, we're trying to direct our energy. Maybe we're trying to direct our energy to our heart. Maybe we're trying to direct it to our spiritual life. But all of these whirling vortices of energy are like little whirlpools in a river. And the river's heading in one direction, but it just gets sucked off. So we're heading in the direction of a calm, happy day, and then all of a sudden somehow we run into something else over here. And we may or may not even know what this is. We just know that the calm, focused direction we were trying to go got eaten by a force over here. And if we're not accustomed to sort of sensing what happens there, then you may just apply willpower to try to sort of get the energy back over to here without actually really realizing, hey, what is it getting sucked into? Why is that happening over there? What am I really feeling? What's at the center of this vortice here? We may be just so accustomed to just trying to just keep the river going that we don't even notice how much of our energy is just locked up in all these other realities that we've been building piece by piece for incarnations, or even just in this lifetime. My mother got mad at me. I never really got to express myself. I just had to bury my anger. I went to school. My teacher treated me unfairly. You know, good girls don't speak up, and so I just got to sort of have it down there. But it doesn't go away. So it makes a whirlpool so that maybe you're just walking along and your husband does something really small. Whoom! You're just gone off over into here. You don't even know how you got there. But it's all of this that has built up a strong whirlpool there, that anything that resembles it, there you go. I've been married twice in my life. My first husband, which was a short marriage, was extremely critical of me. Not verbally, but mentally. Just always was holding me to a standard that was unreasonable, among the many reasons why I didn't stay married to him very long. I married my dear David, who's just so supportive and so nice. And like, after we'd been married a month, and this was so perfect. We lived in this little cabin. We had a wood stove. It was summer. We had a newspaper. We saved newspapers under the house in a box. My husband is extremely exact about everything he does. He has a very scientific, mathematical mind. I don't. Let's just put it there. So I took the newspaper. I tossed it into the box. And it was kind of like half in the box, like that. And he looked at it. He looked at me. And I knew what he thought. No, I put it in the box. I screamed at him. Don't you ever treat me like that. What? You know, I mean, he didn't know where is that coming from. And then I said, it's in the box. I was enraged. He hadn't done a thing. But for all the years I'd been married to the other guy, he was always picking on me mentally for little things that didn't matter. And it just had built up such a field in me, and I was determined we weren't going down that road again. And then I saw, you know, that by the look on the poor man's face, you know, that I was not responding to what was happening now. But I'd started down that road, and one of the vortices in my chakras had just eaten my consciousness. And so that's what we're always fighting against. We're fighting against the accumulated energy of whatever it is that we've built up over so many lifetimes. Now that's the good news, because this doesn't really exist. You know, there's no actual thing in there. There's just a habit. And we can dissolve that habit by many ways. If you're dealing with a whirlpool in a river, you know, and it has a center point, you can get rid of the whole whirlpool by dissolving the center point. So you might have built up this huge thing about your unworthiness in a particular area, but when you actually realize that was just something that my culture, my people convinced me of, there's no truth in that, you can wipe the center out. But the main way you change this flow of the chakras is by adding energy at more expanded levels. And so instead of sort of fighting the constant battle of the lower chakras, we start increasing the energy of the higher chakras, because it's a magnetic relationship. And especially if you add energy to the highest chakra, what happens is the magnetism here, and this is all a magnetic relationship, if the magnetism here is even just one tiny, whatever you would call it, stronger than the magnetism here, the energy flow going that direction will suck that into the flow and it will dissolve. This is the truth of don't worry about anything, just meditate. But one more thing will happen, and then I'll let you answer. One more thing will happen is sometimes when the energy builds up here, this won't go away nicely to the river. And then you have to, then you get to deal with it. But it's been brought out from where it was buried, so at least you're on the list.
Yeah, I was just going to add a quick comment about this, because I know in my own life, you know, anger and upset is a big issue. And my young 20s, I saw a psychologist for a while, a therapist for a period of time. I mean, a lot of therapy is based on trying to analyze what's going on down in these nervous loops.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, just analyzing, you know, what happened with your mother, what happened with your father, what happened as a child. And it can be, I know it was for me, you just end up going around in circles down here for a while. It's what Asha was saying, you know, it's been my experience, is once you focus, instead of focusing on everything that happened in the past and what's all the, you know, what's causing all the problems, we just focus on the energy here and here and raising it up. It just starts to flow up naturally. And well, these things just start to dissolve without having to analyze them.
What also happens is, yes. Mm-hmm. And then what also happens is it slides into your conscious awareness and suddenly you understand it. Sometimes it dissolves without your noticing. But even, Joylynn, even what you're saying now, you're beginning to become aware of something, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're increasing the flow here and it's beginning to pull these energies into conscious awareness. Now, at first that may feel like you're going backwards, but in fact you're going forward because you're pulling, because if you don't know about it, it's still running your life. Because your life is run by the patterns and the chakras, and unconsciousness of those patterns does not make them any less controlling of your life. So when you begin to notice that there's just this confused dynamic to your consciousness, often that's really the very beginning of resolving it. The only benefit of counseling, and I don't want, that's not fair, a great benefit of counseling is if you are a total mystery to yourself, if you cannot predict your reactions, if your reactions do not make sense to you, if you are always attaching the cause of your suffering to the wrong cause, then sometimes it can help you to just try to get some objective picture of what your system really is. But then, as Eric said, most psychology does not have a means for actually dissolving it. We just label it, we study it, we go around in circles talking about it. Whereas spiritual practice understands that this is just a vortex, and if we can increase the flow of energy, then we can dissolve the vortex. That's why people, you know, once they get into serious spiritual practice, or even a tiny bit of spiritual practice, Bhagavad Gita says, even a little practice of this inward religion will free you from dire fears and colossal sufferings. And this is a metaphysical reason why. Increase this even a tiny bit, and to that extent you will begin to dissolve these other vrittis. Because it's metaphysics. That's the way the energy flows. The river, the whirlpool can only suck the water out of the river if the whirlpool is stronger than the flow of the river. The degree to which the flow of the river is stronger, than to that extent the whirlpool is weakened. And then these are our past life, past this life, emotions, feelings, built up ideas of things. And the right kind of spiritual practice. Now, meditation is one aspect of it. There's, you know, it's a huge reality. But that's a simple, plain terms, the practical benefit. And so we can make changes in our life just by trying. But our changes are likely to be more dynamic if we do something. And meditation is one, yoga postures is something, you know, the superconscious living exercises, energization, spiritual reading, prayer, exercise. I mean, there's lots of anything that causes the energy to flow more dynamically upward in a more expansive way. Does that make sense? It's a very short lesson in the chakras, but is there another question or thought about that? Does it relate to what you brought up from the beginning?
Yeah.
Very much.
Certainly.
Yeah, it's very good. Now,
I've realized that Eden has been here at school 3 years.
Uh-huh.
These days I feel like he's much more mature.
Mature.
Than me.
Okay.
I have to keep up.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Listen, both in English.
Yes. More mature, more self-aware.
Right.
And he's also aware of how I react. Mm-hmm. Like my feelings.
Yeah, that's not always welcome, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I sometimes go, oh. So it's amazing.
A little girl who grew up in Ananda Village, her parents were particularly calm and even-minded. But they were in the local town at the laundromat once, and her mother became very angry at her child. And the little girl turned to her mother and said, "Why is that mommy behaving so badly?" She just never seen her own mommy behave that badly. She couldn't understand why. But the truthfully, this concept of the chakras, I mean, I don't think we're going to put it in our brochure about Living Wisdom School, but every Living Wisdom School teacher is really conscious of this. And they're really conscious of the fact that when the child begins to manifest a certain kind of energy, it reflects a certain built-up energy in whatever the corresponding chakra is. And so the teachers understand that it's not just a question of telling that child, control your energy. You know, because to suppress an inclination does not necessarily change the inclination. It could suppress it. It could even suppress it for a lifetime or for many years. But all you've added is you haven't changed the essential energy pattern. You have merely added another pattern which holds this one at bay. But all of that background energy is still there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think to use as a really simple example, the first chakra, which is the earth chakra. Okay, this chakra represents E-A-R-T. Spelling earth right would make me look better. Okay. This is the earth chakra, and each of these corresponds to an element, each chakra. The earth chakra is the physical world. It's the solid world. But what it represents in terms of feeling is security. Okay? Now, security is a natural need. Everyone has to feel secure. That's why I'm saying there's a positive and negative dimension to each chakra. So the question is, where does the person find their security? Now, if we look at adults, some adults find their security by looking outward to the things of this earth. We've got to have lots of money. We need a big home. Sometimes people who are very materialistic in their sense of security, all their furniture is big. Their cars are big. You know, even sometimes their bodies are big. You know, everything just has to be like this. Of course, the problem with seeking your security by getting the material world to stay in place is that it doesn't. You know, you lose your job, economic things change, your wife decides that you're really kind of a jerk and just leaves you, your child turns out to be a lemon. You know, it's like your child has a whole other agenda than the agenda that you have, the family that you're trying to hold together, all these things can happen. But we still need security. So the point is, we need to put our security, our sense of security, in the right things. So our real security comes from our relationship with God. Because the only thing that we can actually really depend on, and I'm going the complete opposite side, because from the earth to the spiritual life, our relationship with the divine. My realization that, you know, I am one with the infinite spirit. What on this earth could ever bother me? Even death itself. You know, death comes, the body dies, I grow old, everything leaves me. My security is my relationship with God. In my marriage, to use that as an example, early on, I did one of those things that women do. The husbands recognize it, and the women recognize it, I'm sure. Where my husband did nothing at all, and I managed to become extremely emotionally upset. Just out of nothing. I just made it up one day, just sitting on the couch, out of whole cloth. You know, I don't know what I did. I don't remember the details, but I did it. And when it all finally got straightened out, I thought, well, you know, how am I going to manage? Because I was newly married, and I'd been single for 10 years, and I wasn't looking forward to this whole cycle again, this part of it. I thought, well, I can trust my husband. I'll get my security from his character, from the fact that he loves me, that he won't let me down. But then I noticed that he hadn't done anything and I'd still gotten upset. And then I also thought, no matter how good a man he is, who knows? You know, he had karma with me, he could have karma with someone else. He could get sick, he could die, he could be in an automobile accident, his personality could change, you know, he could get a debilitating disease. I mean, I cannot depend on him. But I realized that I could trust God to give me the strength to deal with whatever else he sent me. You see that? So my security was my faith in God, which in my particular case was very strong. And if your security, if your first chakra is rooted in your relationship with the divine, what happens outside of God's will? I was in a terrible dilemma once with a group of people, and it was an awful situation. Everyone was terribly upset and involved the hospital. It was a mess. And I had to be the calm, strong one in the whole situation, but, you know, I was losing it pretty bad. So I went out into the parking lot and just put my head down on the steering wheel because it was the only place I could get away, and I was just weeping, weeping. Then this little inner voice came in from the right ear and went out the left ear. Do you think this is happening outside the will of God? It said like that. And I was really sort of annoyed because I was really into being upset, and I couldn't, what could I say? Because I was trapped by my own faith. And I thought, well, no. And then the next question is, then why are you so upset? And I said, well, I'm upset, one, because I'm exhausted, and two, because, and I said to God in this tone of voice, if you have something to teach these people, you'd better help them learn it, because we're all going down for the third time here. And I sort of had this really conversation like that, and I went back into the place, and everything started going the right way. My security had been based on everybody being okay. They weren't okay. What was I going to do then? So I found, again, that this is where it came from. So you have a little child. He's trying to make himself secure by being the big man. So you have a little girl. She's trying to make herself secure by being the pretty little princess. Now, we need to really help these children find security in the right place. This is what I'm saying about the chakras. I went to a school in this area, one of the most respected private schools in this area. Maybe I said this earlier, I don't remember. They were trying to teach self-esteem. You know, everybody tries to teach self-esteem. They had a self-esteem tree. It was a big, this is when we were first founding our school and they were looking at the areas. And on that tree, every child had put a leaf. And every single leaf on that tree, except one, was about an external accomplishment that that child could claim. Their entire self-esteem, their entire sense of self-worth, all their security was based on what they could do. I got the last, you know, I won the soccer game. There was one child who wrote, I'm not as moody as I used to be. But not one of them. And this is the best that this area has to offer. But it was all based on external achievement. And anybody with a brain knows that if you think your self-worth is based on external achievement, you don't feel very good a lot of the time. What if somebody's better than you? What if I can't pass the test? I mean, this is what makes kids crazy. Because we're raising them to be atheists, and we're raising them to believe that their real self-worth is what they do externally. So, Ananda Living Wisdom School is the complete reverse. That's why we're always saying, first of all, you choose your own state of consciousness, you practice kindness, you practice happiness, we celebrate good energy. We're trying to teach them, just using the first chakra, where their security really comes from. It comes from the mastery of their own consciousness. Because just like I solved my fear of my marriage, so to speak, by realizing that God would bring me what I needed and I would be fine. If you know that you have the capacity to cope, that you can master your own energy, that even when you become angry, you have tools for dealing with that anger, then you have a real basis for security. Because it's not based on things going well, it's not even based on you doing well. It's that you really know who you are, where it comes from. So we watch the children, you know, on all levels, and read them according to this system. And we have other vocabulary for it, but this is what we're really reading. And we all understand the positive and negative of each of these qualities. And when we see the negative, we try to pull the child toward the positive so that they can begin to dissolve the vrittis that they already have. And, you know, they walk up to you, and they're a walking, you know, pattern in the chakras. And they have or want, I mean, they're full-blown. And they're naked in it. That's why it's a really good time to work with them.
Is this where the end of your celebration and the name of the qualities and that?
All of that. That's where all of that comes from. All of that comes from an understanding of, you know, and we don't always give the child something they've actually accomplished. Often we're giving the child, you know, the direction that, that we know they need to go. Mm-hmm. And as often as not, we're commending them for waking up to the fact that this is what they need. And it's very mm-hmm. subtle. The teachers work a long time on those qualities and really make sure, especially over years, that they accumulate a whole system for really seeing where they're trying to go. I was very impressed this year in particular somehow. They seemed to be particularly well considered each time. And then the children, you know, they don't surprise the kids with it. It's not like who gets the math award this year. You know, it's like they really, because it's a huge teaching tool.
And has that always been a part of the school since its inception?
Yeah, it's absolutely, it just came right from the start. And our school particular, I think all the Living Wisdom schools do it. We have our own way of doing it. We do it slightly different than some of the other schools do, because we found that it's such a fabulous teaching tool for the children. And then the children, you know, they have to think about it for a long time. What does this really mean? And you see, we're commending them for qualities of character and of consciousness. You know, that we're not, I mean, we do, they get prizes for this and that. But you see, we don't single the children out all the time and say, you're the smartest in this, you're the best in this, you're the most outstanding. Sometimes people come in and they want us to pit the children against each other and give them competitions. You know, we don't give grades. Every so often, somebody will try giving grades. I mean, the basic, this is the summary of the assumption, give them grades and all learning stops. Because as soon as they can call in an A or a B or a C or a D, I mean, I know they know what they miss on their test, but as soon as you give them an external standard, that just becomes the reality. There was a, you may remember a few years ago at the Cupertino High School, there was a huge cheating scandal. And because the kids had figured out, I don't know whether they hacked the computers or what they did, but they found a way to get better grades without actually getting the grades. And there were many dimensions of that scandal. I actually watched it and tried to think if I could get involved, but I didn't know how to step in. Because one of the most horrifying features of it to many of the people who were pontificating was that the kids were a little bewildered as to why everybody else was so upset. Because their essential statement, which I read in the paper, was, nobody ever asked me if I was learning anything. You all just asked me what my grades were. You know? I mean, they could even go so far as say nobody ever gave a damn whether I was learning anything. Just wanted to know what my grades were. So I found an easier way to get a grade. So, like, what is the problem here? And it was, and I actually had to respect those kids. It was a perfectly honest response to the actual situation at hand. You know, now that is the most extreme example. And In our situation, I know this girl, her name is Sandy, when she went from the Ananda school up through eighth grade, like we have here at Ananda Village, and then went into Nevada City, Nevada Union then. Mm-hmm. I don't think we had a high school then. She immediately appeared on the honor roll and, you know, in the community up in the hills there. You know, Sandy's on the honor roll. So I saw her. I said, good work, you know, you made whatever you did. Oh, she said, it's ridiculously easy. She said, in that school, she said, all I have to do is answer the problems and I get a good grade. She said, when I was here, I had to be in a good mood, I had to work with good energy, I had to walk with my friends. She said, there, I just get the problems right. Nobody asked me anything else. She said it was just a snap. It just meant nothing to her. That's what Brian McSweeney said when Gary's son, when he went from here to St. Francis. He just laughed. It was laughable. Because they suddenly, his education narrowed down to, you know, a hair's width, and that's all that he was asked to do. And the way he described it is that he was a lot more aware than anybody else, most everybody else, because he had this dimension that he was thinking of. This is what education is. He's so much his father's son. He was such a solid man, you know, that he just rode through it and had fun. But he was always aware of is just the shrinking down to nearly nothing, which is why we need a high school. Because who knows about this? Who's thinking like this? In my own life, the chakras have been one of the most useful things that I know. Because when I find myself tumbling someplace I don't want to go, I just think to myself, you know, this isn't a catastrophe. This doesn't mean I'm an evil person. This is just a vortex of energy in one of my chakras, and I think of it as the marble of my consciousness has just gotten sort of sucked into this, And if I can just create magnetism somewhere else. And that's, it also says, okay, bad enough that I've fallen into this pit, let me not make it worse by believing in it too intensely, freaking out over its happening, you know, because you can add a whole nother layer of guilt and shame and fear and, you know, bad enough. Let me just run this one through. And as soon as I get my head above water, I'll go back where I want to go. And then the only problem I will have is what's already there. This is why guilt and shame and all of those things don't serve you, because all they do is create more of these little things for you to get eaten up by later. I say, bad enough you have the problem, let's not make a complex about it too. I used to say it's better to just sin enthusiastically in public and then go on. You know? Just let it, if you've got it in you, just put it on the sidewalk and then just go on after that. As I was saying yesterday, actually, at Sunday service, it's nothing to be proud of, but there's no reason to be ashamed either. It just is what it is, and then let's just go on from there. That's what we try to teach the kids too. Okay, so you know, you fell into this, whatever it might be. I know everybody's child has some, everybody, every human being has children, has issues. It's just that when they're children, they're more on the table. They haven't learned to dissemble, that's the word.
Some of these little vortices that you're saying to me, uh-huh. especially around my own children, is, for me, my wife, is thinking about the childhood that we had and either trying to compensate or overcorrect or whatever. In other words, our own sort of baggage from
uh-huh.
there gets lumped onto them, creating yet another cycle of problems.
Yeah, there you have it. But, of course, your children were drawn to you because there was a magnetic relationship between the pattern in your chakras and the pattern in theirs. So they would never have entered into that if there wasn't a resonance that required whatever you're giving them. That doesn't excuse you. But it does, in our community, this is how it manifests. There was this man in the community, and he has no children of his own, but he's kind of the everybody's uncle. And especially a lot of the early teens and the teenagers, he befriended them, and it's been a very wholesome thing. So in our community, when your child says, "You're a terrible mother and I hate you," you say, "Don't blame me, you chose me." It's your karma, you know. I didn't know who I was getting. You're the one who decided, right?
Maybe that's a good one.
Yeah. Okay, so that works when they're little, maybe. But then they get to be teenagers, and they came to this Uncle Brian, and so they would say to him, "I would never have chosen them." You know? And so then they start challenging the whole philosophy, because they know for a fact they would never have chosen. So then Brian comes to Swami Kriyananda and says, "What do I say?" You know? And he answered by saying, "Well, you might not choose every single detail of the situation." But generally speaking, if there wasn't a resonance, and, you know, to be frank, you know, sometimes the child is more connected to the mother or the father or to a sibling. You know, the combinations are all very different, but there had to be enough, else you wouldn't have come together. And so that's a way to ease guilt, because you're really not creating this child's reality. You are responding to it. And so you have to work on your response, but you're not creating it. He or she would not be there. Here's my, do you want to know my best don't feel guilty as a parent picture? This requires reincarnation, but we're just going to pretend because it's so liberating. According to the masters, we've had a lot of incarnations. I mean, really, a lot of incarnations. Every time we incarnate, we have parents. Okay? And so, but when we're born, there's a trajectory of energy. We're not born just inert. We don't even enter. I mean, the sperm and the ovum come together, Yogananda says, and there is, I love this, a flash of light in the astral world. And the soul that's in tune with it will try to get in. And they don't always all get in. Sometimes two get in. One of my friends, her son said, 5 years old, "I hate you, Mommy," like they do sometimes. Then he walks out of the room, and that wasn't even enough. So he comes back and he said, "You weren't even my first choice." And she suddenly became very interested. "Well, honey, who was your first choice?" And he said back to her, "A lady in the Philippines, but she was taken." So much later, many years later, I'm talking about the flash of light in the astral world, and that souls sometimes compete to get into the womb. And she started to laugh and laugh because her son makes a fast decision and then hesitates. And she could just see him, seeing that flash of light in the world, in the astral world, heading for that womb in the Philippines, then holding back for just a second. It's an object in motion,
yeah.
You know. It's an object in motion, so they hit you with an object in motion has a force field that's going to take it where it's going to go. It's not like you're creating a vehicle, physical body vehicle, family life context, raising and nurturing context for the inner reality of that soul, just as all of us, to express itself. So we have parents in every one of these incarnations, like this, right? You know, and then here you are right now, you know, like, and then yesterday you were a little mean. Like, how do you think that fits in? It matters, but you know, there's so much else that's happening, that's going on, and your response is important because we live in the now. But don't make the mistake of thinking that you are really determining your child's destiny. That's just a little grandiose. You are responding to his force, and you can definitely be of service to your child. There's no question that you can be of service, but you're in it together. And he or she did choose you. I mean, I'm amused, especially. I mean, I have a few friends. As a child, I never knew there was such a thing as an oops baby, but now, of course, as an adult, I realize that not every single pregnancy was like really plotted out. And one of, you know, a friend of mine had one of those like super oops, like how could there be a worse time to be pregnant than now, babies. And the situation the child was born in was chaotic, very chaotic. In her life, the father's life, it was just very chaotic. Daughter was really mad at the mother for a long time. One day I thought, honey, you know, sex happens a lot, and then you decided to be conceived right now? You picked the worst time in the world and you're blaming me. And there's truth to it. And that doesn't get us off the hook, but that is to say that there's a force here. And you're giving the child a vehicle for it to live through its karma. In our school, I mean, these are like the things that you can't always talk about at the most public meeting, but we're not in one right now. You know, you're sitting, as I say, on the Ananda side, so I tell you what we talk about when we're all by ourselves. You know, these souls are... have come to us for a reason. They were not always children, they were grown-ups. They've had full, huge lives before this moment, and they're just children right now. So we don't actually think of them as children. And that's one of the most fundamental differences between our school and pretty much any school you're going to go to, is the metaphysical reality created by Paramahansa Yogananda, who's the founder of the school, articulated by Swami Kriyananda, that this is a force, a divine individual force that has a destiny, and we're going to work with him. Yes, right now the context is 6 years old. You know, the context is reading, the context is picking up trucks and bashing your friends. But the real context is their realities are every bit as complete and as serious and as, you know, what they do right now is the same as what they're going to do when they're 45 or 50. There's no intervening because they're working on their consciousness now as much as they ever will. They're just working in their... See, it's just as important what happens now, even though it's child context. But it's not childish, you know, at all. And, you know, in fact, we were talking to some of the teachers and I, and we were saying, you know, and to a certain extent, parents celebrate childhood. You know, because that's what you're there. You're there to have fun. But teachers really, in a real sense, almost ignore childhood. You know, they don't ignore it because we have to do developmentally appropriate things, of course. And our understanding of the four tools of maturity go sequentially from the physical to the feelings to the will to the intellect. That's the basic four tools of maturity over 6 year cycles. I can say that more carefully. So you have to work developmentally. But the issue is It's never unimportant. It's never unimportant, but it has to be important in the right context. They are children. You can't treat them like adults developmentally. You can't let them make decisions that they shouldn't be allowed to make. You can't let them have free will when their will needs to be restrained. But nonetheless, you're relating to them with a certain profound respect. And you know that's the foundation of everything here. It's just profound respect for that individual soul and its destiny. And this is a very tricky business for us because we can use certain words and then we watch all the schools around co-opt our words. And we unfortunately know for a fact that they're not doing what we're doing. I mean, we'd love it if they would, but we know from knowing them and knowing their philosophy, knowing their background, knowing their teacher training, they can't be because they don't have, they're not, they weren't founded by Paramahansa Yogananda and Swami Priyananda. They weren't founded from this other point of view, which is not about any religion. It's just about the meaning of life, where we came from, where we're going, and how we get there. And, you know, we discuss a lot about how to present ourselves, and we've been trying to work this out over 20 years. And sometimes we say more, sometimes we say less. I have this tremendous freedom to say anything I want because I'm not the principal of the school anymore. In the years when I was, I had to, one of the reasons I didn't do so well at it is because I had, well, I did fine at it. It's just the school got bigger than me. And then it got bigger than me and we had to get Helen.
So what's the relationship, you think, like externally for people who look at the new wisdom and think within progressivism and child progressivism and John Dewey and those people who talked about the child as individual and let the child lead and unfold and that kind of thing. They seem not to have a lot of the soul context.
Right. I mean, and so what happens is, really, children are quite uncivilized and rather stupid for a really long time. And I think it's quite unwise to let them lead too much because they don't know where they're going. Now, you have to ask that question of Helen because I'm entirely 100% ignorant of what John Dewey actually said. So my response is that when parents turn over to children decisions and that are not age appropriate, that seems to me like you're abdicating your responsibility, because respecting them on a soul level does not preclude the fact that you are now a child and you don't know what you're doing. But it does also bring into it a kind of respect for what's happening there that you don't have unless you realize that it's reincarnation, and there's no other word for it. Reincarnation changes the whole reality. And of course, this system was founded in India by Yogananda, in which reincarnation was just the given. It was assumed karma and reincarnation is everything. In Swami Kriyananda's book, he masks it in Education for Life, because we can do a great deal of good for a great many people without their having to embrace everything. But one way or another, an Education for Life teacher has to grasp the actual nature of what a child is, which is to say, the actual nature of what I am. I mean, we were talking about this. I said, you have to relate soul to soul. Someone said, well, how do you do that? I said, well, you have to find your own first. If you don't have a relationship with your own soul, it's very difficult. And by soul, I think I use the word jiva. I mean that enduring spark of divinity that simply wears the body for the duration of the time that it's useful. But then it comes in as child, and it has to be your parent. You know, I'm sorry. Right now, I'm the daddy, and you know, this is what daddies do. And you're the kid. When you're my father in another incarnation, we can do this differently. One little boy, I mean, this is more like just the things children say. He knocked over the milk at the dinner table for the 10th day in a row, and the father got very impatient. And the little boy just looked at him. When you were the little boy and I was the father, I was very patient with you. you're trapped. But right now you are the father or the mother, and you have a responsibility, and it's your karma to have the courage to be responsible for that child and not just whatever that phrase actually means, let the child lead. You should be responsive to the child's deeper reality. But
you have to teach them across the street.
Yeah. And you also have to teach them you know, your child may want to do things that are not going to be in his best interest. And even here in our environment, and this is something, again, that we end up in, sometimes it's hard with the parents. You know, they want, their child can excel in this little fragment of reality, and they want us to just build this child out that way. But we see that what the child's real issue is way over here. And if we don't deal with this issue and just let the child build this, they're not going to end up anywhere that they really want to be. And so we often, you're in sort of a tussle with what parents want and what we perceive. And I don't, you know, I think I could only imagine, because I don't have kids, I think it's hard to be objective about your children. This is what I've observed.
I'll just comment, just what happens a lot with parents, and I know it happened in my own household too, is that they're very much attracted to the Buddhism school and the whole philosophy when they're young, but then when they go out with their friends and they're talking, all their friends are talking about how good their son or daughter is doing in this test or that test.
Oh, the parents.
The parents are, right? The parents are talking about this. And so it just creates this huge dichotomy in the parents' mind. And it's like all they're talking about, and they may even get to a situation where, you know, a younger daughter of a friend's, you know, knows their times table before their son does or something silly like that.
Oh, it's not silly to the parents.
I feel silly too, but
there's no evidence that kind of precociousness actually results in anything better either.
No, I'm not speaking from experience, because that set me up a little bit too. Is that, you know, a younger cousin knew the times table before our kid.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, my son, you know, now was, you know, a year ahead and done high school, so it didn't make any difference at all. It didn't hold him back at all. But it's, you know, it's all about getting a grade ahead is what they all talk about. And it just becomes such a narrow focus on the academics that everything, you know, they don't even talk about anything else. And so as a parent, I really sympathize, because you're here and you're talking about, oh, they'll be us talk about all this, but then out in the other world, all the other parents are talking about just getting ahead of academics.
Well, I'll tell you what Swami Kriyananda said to us when we started the school. I mean, Swami Kriyananda, that's his picture. He's the founder of Ananda. He wrote Educating for Life. I know him very well. He's still living. He's 86. He said, if you can make it work in Palo Alto, we can make it work anywhere. He said, and you are right across the street from Stanford. I said, yeah, right in the lion's den, sir. And I mean, from day one, that's been the story. The kindergarten mother, 4 years old, she put her child in our school. Literally, she knew intuitively her child belonged here. The end of this story is not a happy one, but she knew intuitively her child belonged here. When she decided, this was when I was still leaving it, she threw her arms around me, collapsed against me, sobbed on my shoulder. And these are her exact words: but I'm so afraid if I bring her to kindergarten here, she won't be able to get into Harvard. And I had to just like breathe in and breathe out, because she's having a real experience. I can't just dismiss it. She's really, you know, she loves her daughter and she's terribly worried. I tried to say to her, you know, I think she'll have a better chance by starting here, because she will develop all aspects of herself. She's not going to go to Harvard for a long time. And at the age of 4, according to the development of true maturity, which is the goal, you're working with a certain reality. You're not yet working with her ability to do calculus. And she won't be better at calculus by skipping all the other developmental stages. In fact, the kids just fry at that point. You know, they've never... But anyway, that woman, just to make it terrible, she got a brain tumor and she died. And her daughter being in our school was so that we could take her and her husband and her daughter through the living nightmare that their family became. And, you know, we really did. I mean, literally, I sat there in the hospital room and helped her die. And we just took that whole family through that whole thing, and that's why she needed to be with us. We don't know what we're doing a lot. But it was also real. I mean, the actual result of her life just made her concerns folly. But they were so real. It was just, that's when I thought again of Swami Kriyananda. Okay, if we can make it work here, we can make it work anywhere. But the point is, which is so annoying to me, everything about our world is changing now. Nobody has any idea what these children are going to need to know. You can learn, you can get all the facts right. You can have all the skills you need. And by the time you graduate from college, it could all be obsolete. You know, our culture is changing, our technology is changing, the requirements of the workforce are changing. What people need to know is how to learn, how to be confident in themselves, how to get along with other people, how to be creative, how to see how things relate to each other, how to be strong in yourself, how to make your own opportunities, how to have magnetism, living wisdom school curriculum. Just, and we've had people who are wise enough to see it. This is the education of the future. This, you know, training them in all these facts from 4 years old, where will that take them in today's world? And it's a very real thing. Where will it take them? What we were educated, and I'm a generation older than all of you, useless. It really is. Just one of my friends who got her degree in computer. You know, it was like by the time she finished all her education, she didn't know anything. She had to just start over because the whole technology had already flipped. You all know that. You're out in that field. I'm not. You know, what is the key to success? That's what we're giving these children. So even on the most materialistic terms. Now, I don't know whether Harvard's going to catch up in time. But even just in terms of having the confidence to go in there and take those tests and just, you know, be able to put yourself in them. We teach them. We have to teach them to be able to take all those tests and things. You can't just ignore it.
For a mom or a dad who has those aspirations.
That's right.
That has those aspirations for their child.
Right.
Say, well, I want my child to go to Harvard. One of the things that I would think of, you know, is like, well, that's your projection of what you think the child's going to be.
That's another point. That's a whole other issue. I mean, when the woman's crying on my shoulder, many things are going through my mind. Like, well, what if she doesn't want to? What if ballet is her passion? The other is, this is her best chance.
Right.
So, you know, I went a little more that way, and finally I just let her cry until she was finished. I think she knew things in her soul that she wasn't saying, given how things actually turned out.
But I guess that most parents seem to want what they think is best for the children, because I do think that this is the idea that they are shaping the child rather than welcoming in a soul to this new experience, and that will unfold. And as you say, there's a role for the parent, but it's not to determine who that child will be, because he is or she is who they are already.
But the parent, yes, absolutely. But parents are well-meaning in their intention. You know, I never got a professional degree, and look how I've had to struggle financially, so I want you to go to law school.
Right.
It's the desire to share, to spare the child what you've suffered. Or I've had to work for this dopey corporation all my years, you should go into business for yourself. You know, work for the government, that's the secure job. I mean, you know, it's just whatever it might be. One of the girls who's a graduate, actually she's the daughter of Nitai, who's the founder, who was the first founding teacher 40 years ago. She lived in Argentina. These kids, the kids from these schools do interesting things. She decided she was a dancer. She was a dancer. She went to the University of Santa Cruz. The dance department she found was terrible. So she wandered around till she found the teacher she enjoyed most. So she got a degree in astronomy, just sort of randomly, because that was the most interesting class. And as soon as she graduated, she went back to dancing, which is all she ever wanted to do. She decided she wanted to be fluent in Spanish and learn how to tango. So she moved to Argentina. And she now she's back in the Bay Area, and she's a world-class tango dancer. She travels all over the world teaching people how to tango, and she's fluent in Spanish. And someone of her friends said, you know, she said, you're lucky. And then she thought better. She said, no, she said, you're not lucky. She said, you make your own opportunities. And that was like, if we wanted to summarize the whole thing, you know, that if you have magnetism and creativity and confidence, you make your own opportunities. And magnetism is a word that counts. You know, you just have the charisma, the magnetic force, the creative intelligence to see what's going on and then figure out how you can fit, instead of just waiting to have the test score come in and see if you can be at the top. I mean, she's made such an unusual life for herself. Just, I mean, she's a wonderful person too, and one of the reasons she succeeds. You can Google her, Mirabai Duranja. You can watch her tango. Very sexy, very beautiful. You know, not exactly what her father had in mind for her. But her dad says, "Well, yes, it's a very sensual dance." He says it casually, but you know, that is what she really wanted to do.
So now that we have this, like, the six night series of a basic foundation of education for life.
I hope.
And then the all the experiences to come from that.
Right.
Would it be? Is it possible then to connect with our teachers, second grade, third grade, as we move up with our children, and talk to our teachers at this with this kind of?
I hope so. I mean, let me say, it's absolutely there to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely there to happen, and you know, as you all know, because you've all been part of it, there's been this big shift in our school this last couple of years with. Some what had been core faculty leaving and other new faculty coming in, but also mainly core faculty leaving. All that shifting, even though it was a little destabilizing for a while, has actually made it possible to be much more settled and much more clear about what we're doing. Much more clear about it. There wasn't always an entire agreement about what we were doing, which is why the division happened. You know, as happens, you start together and then you end up with slightly different points of view. And so we started together, but we actually diverged quite some time ago, and the reason there actually was a shift like that is because we weren't all quite on the same page. I don't think, you know, where the faculty that went away, they're not on a bad page by any means. You know, they're on a wonderful page. They're wonderfully competent, excellent people, but they're not exactly on the same page. So now there's been a certain clarification and freedom that's come into Living Wisdom School that we weren't all quite on the same page.
And so part of that freedom is the recognition that we can talk about these spiritual principles, whereas, you know, the group that, you know, is doing something else, it's still not part of the open discussion. So, so the faculty is very much more open now and wants to engage more like this. Deeper spiritual.
I mean, every teacher will talk to you like this. Ruth is newer, so she's sort of learning more. Ruth is naturally in tune, but she's having to learn the vocabulary. You know, Ruth is a first class teacher who's very in tune with what we're doing, but she's having to learn the vocabulary just because of the point of view from the point of view of conversation. All the other teachers are more trained in this, but Ruth is a quick learner and has all the pieces in place, so it becomes a more matter of vocabulary and just sort of understanding from this point of view. But she's a real professional, so she's right in there with it. Everybody has slightly different backgrounds, and this isn't sectarianism. Not every Living Wisdom School teacher has to be as dedicated to this as I am. These are universal principles that you become engaged in and begin to understand. And yes, this is exactly how we should all be talking to each other. You know, the culture of Living Wisdom School has to be generated and understood. We're just new. To me, this is like, I love new. I love unformed and seeing where it's going and laying the groundwork and having big, you know, confusions and then sorting them out again. I mean, that's the fun of life, and then everything becomes. And that's right where we are right now.
I say this because, like, last year when I met with Erica, I was very not informed about the sort of all the underpinnings.
Yeah.
And the conversations with Erica were very, very helpful and attuned to what I could understand.
Right.
And then this year, I came to the end of the year conference with a much deeper level of awareness of what the work is about.
Right.
And I sensed her also able to connect with me. You know, there was some kind of the beginnings of a shared understanding. How the school works.
Well, that's exactly true. Erica herself is the product of this. You know, she grew up and her father has my position in Portland. And Erica lived with us in the Ananda community when she was 5 years old. So, I mean, she grew up in this system and was educated. So not only is she educated as a teacher in it, but she actually is the product of it. So she's very, very well informed. Yes. And yes, because some parents are not, they just don't want to know, and so we have to talk to everybody, but that's life. The goal of education for life is true maturity, the ability to relate to realities other than your own.
Mm-hmm.
So if a teacher is sitting with a parent who has a particular set of understandings, and we all know that we're all working together for the good of your child, let's talk in ways that we can all understand. What would be the point of my talking to you in a vocabulary that will be meaningless to you? I need to talk in your vocabulary, what you're interested in, what you want. But if you can talk to me about my reality, then we're all on a different page with that. But I think that we have work to do as a school to bring a common understanding that doesn't necessarily go as far as this, but goes a lot farther than we've gone. Because there is too much incomprehension, and Helen and everybody is really working on it now. You know, this last year and a half has been a course correction that we're now really settled in and can go forward in a much more dynamic way from here. That makes sense?
Yes.
Yeah. And the teachers who used to be with us, and I mean, I really want to say that, they're actually very good education for life teachers. They're not working from a different system. You know, these things become, the differences between you become exaggerated when in fact they're really rather small, but sometimes two ships are better than one.
I've always had the image that, you know, the LWS here is like, you know, the mass consciousness is kind of right here. And what they're doing now is probably, you know, is a step up from it. But then LWS is kind of up here, is what we're really targeting for. So, I mean, I think, you know, they'll actually probably be very successful because it's easier to go out, you know, closer to where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you know, we're really trying to teach, you know, the deep soul level for children. Can we just, and kind of off-tangent comment, too?
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to, just what we were talking about before, if you're working in your own anger, it's one of the things that I've, you know, dealt a lot with in the past, and especially when you have that mentality, you can see where you want to be, and when you're not there, you can also get very self-critical of yourself, and it becomes very hard to work with yourself when you're self-critical of that. I mean, if you just find yourself in an angry spot, it's just breathing into the heart.
Yeah, all good.
Yeah, just breathing into the heart and relaxing the face at the same time is very useful. And then if you just make the effort, that's success. Whether you are able to overcome the anger is totally, you think in your mind, is totally irrelevant. Just, you know, celebrate the fact that you made an effort. And don't even worry whether you're able to overcome the anger.
But I want to add to that what Eric just said. There's a strong metaphysical reason why that's true. Because if you make an effort, I mean, I don't have a pattern, if you make an effort to overcome the anger, you're putting energy into a higher chakra. And even if the vortex is, vritti is the word, if the vortex is still spinning, but you've also added energy to a higher chakra, so not immediately, but you're winning the battle. Because instead of just diving into the same old pool, you clung desperately to the branch before you dived into the same old pool, you know. But you've changed. You've begun to change the magnetism, and so the next time it happens, there'll be a little bit, there'll be a stronger vortex at a slightly higher level. And over day by day, life by life, what were we going to say?
I was just going to say, and don't even think that you're going to, this isn't something you solve in days, weeks, months, or years. This is decades. And just
I
not have any point. I'm going to have that. You know, it's going to take me 2 decades.
I never know whether to tell them that or not, but you told them.
So you don't need to get upset with yourself. With, you know,
but even a little practice of this inward religion will save you from dire fears and colossal suffering.
If you can just take one relaxed breath every time you're angry, that will change your life.
It's actually the truth. The way I put it is, even if you can't do your best, if you can avoid doing your worst, you have made progress.
You neutralize it.
Yeah.
Right? You don't really do the best, but at least do enough to neutralize it.
Or at least not make it as horrible as it could be.
Than
yeah.
You did a year ago.
Yeah. it's 2 years. I started practicing yoga 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
So the whole meditation and yoga.
Yeah.
And I can kind of see the changes that happened to me in the last 2 years.
Exactly.
It's tremendous. I mean, I'm still not there yet. But even the little things that I do consciously and with all my awareness, I can say that I have I have lowered my anger 60%. I mean, that's a lot.
No,
oh
no,
my
that's
God.
In 2 years. That's 2 years.
Yeah.
It's
a stress.
Yeah.
It's a lot, but still not 100%. I want to get to 100%. But
yeah.
Even that, whatever improvement, it goes a long way. Still, I'm not there.
I have been involved with this teaching as my 100% life since I was, well, since I was 19, but really since I was 22, since I was 24. Most of that time, I have been in a position like this, which is I'm talking to people who often are just starting. That's just been the role that I've had. I never cease to be astonished how much change can happen and how fast. And I'm awestruck by how total the change can be if you just keep trying.
Okay.
Exhibit A. I'm just somebody I never was. Absolutely a totally new person without ever having actually succeeded at anything. The only thing I succeeded in doing was not quitting. But because I didn't quit, you know, there was never any big moments. I can't really think of any big dramatic victories. I have a very dull life that way. But I never quit. That was all that was asked of me. I never quit. And then eventually you look back and you realize, wow, I look how different I am. You know, it's really startling. Well, we've reached the end point of the last point of the last class. Are we okay? I'm sorry you didn't join us earlier.
They're on audio tape.
Yeah, I got the tape, so I apparently thought this was the third class, so I don't know how I missed.
I hardly know what month it is. The only way I know is that I write the numbers down in my calendar and I can open up and see.
Probably that's why Annika never replied to me.
You know, I want to tell you, I have so enjoyed this. It's just been a whole new dimension for me, and I've enjoyed knowing all of you. Actually, personally, and dealing with the subject, being with Eric, it's just been really fun. I don't know what the future will hold, you know, I mean, in terms of what I'll be able to do in the future, but I certainly, in principle, really like it. I think you'll find, I mean, I'm just one of many. I took this on also because you don't ask the school teachers to do anything extra in May, not if you really want to be their friend. So when this idea came up, Jack, Helen actually, because she's a great saint, offered to do it. I said, Helen, you know what? Why don't I just do all those classes? Yeah, she said that was.
And I thought, well, maybe we should put it off for the fall. But no, because let's do what we can now.
Yeah. And it was just great for me because Mondays, I used to do a different Monday class and it kind of collapsed on me, so here I was at Mondays. This is my job, so it's not hard for me to do it. Well, it's been a pleasure. Who are your children?
Egan.
Egan.
Yeah.
Oh, Egan. Oh, I love Egan. He's a great kid. Yeah. Excellent.
All right.
Thank you so much. Certainly. Is there anything more that, because you just came, I mean, is there anything particular questions? I mean, everyone else can go if you like, but is there anything else I could say to you that could help you?
Actually, I've been listening to the tapes,
okay.
So the two tapes I did listen, so probably I've listened somewhere.
Okay.
But I don't have any particular question at this point of time.
Okay.
Yeah, but I do have other personal questions that I want to ask
you. Okay, so let's wait a minute, then I'll turn off the recording.